Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Road to Recovery podcast. This podcast is a platform for education, discussion, and conversations on mental health. I'm your host, Amira Shah, and in this podcast, you'll get to know more about the therapeutic process, insight into life from the perspective of the psyche, and also join me in exploring current issues with other practitioners. I specialize in grief, but I'm always interested in learning about the human experience of the mind, heart, and spirit. So join me on this journey of in-depth learning about ourselves and the world we live in. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Science of the Soul. Today I have with me Lisa Chiang. Lisa is a university counselor, and Lisa and I actually did our master's at university together. So, hi Lisa, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Amira, for inviting me over to have this chat and share, you know, a bit more about what we do as counselors as well. And just a little bit more about myself. So currently, I'm a university counselor, but I also work in a project management role at a university and really about the well-being of students, because we, you know, it's a big focus for us and we want to make sure that we take care of the well-being of students. A little bit more about me. My background is in nutrition, so a little bit different from the usual counselor. And I also have a big interest in all the different lifestyle factors that contribute to mental well-being, and that sort of spurred me on to study lifestyle medicine. So I also have a board certification in lifestyle medicine and a fellowship with the Australasian Society of Lifestyle Medicine. That's a bit of a mouthful, hey?
Yeah. So maybe we can help our listeners understand what you do a little bit better. What exactly is lifestyle medicine?
That's a really good question, because I think it's not very well understood. So basically, lifestyle medicine is about the treatment, prevention, reversal of chronic diseases through lifestyle factors. As we know, you know, exercise is really important for our health, but it's also really important for our mental health. And mental health is a type of chronic disease as well. So we're looking at lifestyle factors such as exercise, nutrition, sleep hygiene, you know, good sleep time, kind of bedtime routines, things like smoking cessation, like alcohol reduction, and also things like motivational interviewing, where you're, you know, talking to them, I suppose, your clients through like factors of why and how to adopt good habits for their life.
Mm. And does social interaction fall under this?
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, in the blue zones, actually one of the common factors in all of the blue zones, and the blue zones are where we have a lot of centenarians, so a lot of people who are living healthy and well into, you know, the hundreds, is that social connection is one of the really important factors, that people are still interacting with their community, they're still getting up and going to the marketplace and they're talking. But that also brings about a lot of physical activity and a lot of sense of purpose, because there are still things that they're doing. They're still gardening, they're still growing, they're still cooking, they're still joining in all the community affairs, all the community gossip, you know. So all of that is really actually important parts of our life that we tend to ignore. We tend to think about just like, how much am I eating, or what am I eating, and how much exercise am I doing? But we forget about all these little things that also add up to our well-being.
And in a sense, when you think about mindset, it shifts you away from the I and me and more towards the us and the we, when you're in a community setting or a communal setting.
Yeah, I think that's really important as well. And that, you know, being with other people and, you know, being part of that community and contributing to that community gives you that sense of being able to pass on tradition, being able to pass on values and support. You see in different cultures now as well, they have these like maybe even community sort of banking, community pools that come together where, you know, they support each other. When their farming is no good, somebody else is able to chip in and support. And that reliance on each other, that's really age old, really, isn't it? That sense of community. So absolutely, community is really important. Just like you and me, man, we are part of community, and that support is so important. Even as counselors, having that community of support, able to, grow together and learn together and support each other. And it's really important, because I think in this work, especially as we do, can become really challenging without that community support.
Yeah. I mean, counselors often get quite siloed. I think psychologists as well. I'm not too sure about psychiatrists, but when you're working in the mental health profession, you don't really sit down with your other colleagues in an office and then chat and have lunch and then go out for drinks afterwards. It's not something that we generally do.
Yeah.
And a lot of us are women as well, as a female dominated environment. Mm-hmm. So we go home to families because we gotta, right? Yeah. So we miss out on that community experience. And I think, at least from my experience, it does take a concerted effort in an individualistic Western society to hone and refine our sense of community with each other.
Absolutely. I think it's such an integral part of being able to thrive in this world, is mm-hmm. that sense of community, that sense of belonging, and that support that we get from each other. I definitely, you know, wouldn't do a lot of things that I've done in my life or dared to without you and my other community supports that have believed in me. And, you know, and that is so important. I think that, you know, we have our cheerleaders in that community. And also, but not only that, it's also to, you know, when we're doing something that they don't think is aligned with our values or our beliefs, to call us up on some of these things. So I think that sense of support and community and being able to be vulnerable with people as well, I think that's so important. And that certainly has not been something that communities have done that well in the past, I think, is to embrace that vulnerability. As you can see, I think for the cultures that we come from, you know, there's a lot of that sense of having to behave in a certain way and to, you know, hide our weaknesses. But as we have developed community and we rethink about how community is important, about seeing the whole of us, is that we dare then to be vulnerable and to be open in that space. And that really brings that true sense of connection. And it's really beautiful as well, isn't it?
It's a sense of growing together. And I guess when you have those social stigmas whereby you don't feel like you can open up and be fully vulnerable and honest with each other for the sake of saving face or whatever it is, we just can't grow as a human being, and let alone grow as each other together. And then when a friend of ours in our friend group suddenly has a breakdown, we'd end up saying, I had no idea this is happening to this person. Which brings me to a different point, actually. This might be a bit of a digression, but in the Exodus, in the Bible, there was a lot of emphasis on the Sabbath, which is this Saturday, or the thing Saturday into Sunday, if I'm not mistaken. And there's also a lot of emphasis of that being the time that you spend with your family. And there's also a lot of emphasis on having family meals, you know, with the sacrificial idea whereby, you know, you sacrifice something and you feed it to your tribe and your family, and this person gets this much and blah 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 and all that. It gets a bit dogmatic, but I think the underlying philosophy is the sharing of food, which also means the sharing of connection and knowing each other and communicating with each other, so that when something goes wrong, you can pick up on it and you can step in and help each other out, because you know something is off. You know, you can kind of nip it in the bud, in a sense. You might not know what it is exactly, but if you don't talk to each other and you don't commune together, and eating together is such an archaic, primitive, primal, you know, biological, evolutionary, all those words, sense of humanity, then, and then if you think about how we are these days, we're always, well, not we are always, but I sometimes find myself eating alone quite often, and that actually makes me a bit sad, because I grew up in a culture where we always ate together and we talked and, you know, we aired our grievances and celebrated each other's successes together. So definitely, I think when you talk about nutrition and lifestyle medicine, I'm also thinking about what are we eating and who we are eating with, and what happens while we're eating and partaking in these activities, like the people in the blue zone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I'm glad you touched upon that point. Food is not just about nutrition, or in the sense of how much nutrients you're getting. But I mean, you can think of it as nutrition, because it is nutritious for us. It is growing us in our souls. It's that sense of connection. And that also that contribution, right? That, you know, the mom or the parent or the person that prepares the food puts a lot of love and attention and values and tradition and into their cooking. And, you know, it's a labor of love that brings people together. Absolutely, that food, you know, you know, like now even with the fasting and the Ramadan, how much food, you know, is centered around eating together at the end of the day, when you're coming together, and that big sense of community and that breaking fast or breaking food together and eating together just really connects us in a joyous way, because there is that sense of meeting our physical needs, but also meeting our emotional needs. And, you know, I've tried my best as well to pass that tradition and continue that. We always, like, as a family, eat together. And I think in the main meal, which is the dinner of the day, because of course lunch, kids are at school, I'm at work, but trying to have that space to talk, to communicate, ask ourselves about the day, ask ourselves about the food and how delicious it is. And that's an important part as well, is that when we are enjoying these things together and we're thinking about it, it brings us into the present moment.
Yeah.
And that is a part of that lifestyle factors where we are, you know, always nowadays so caught up in the busyness, in the doing, that we often don't remember to come back to the simple things in life, to come back to being present.
The being mode, yeah.
To being together with each other, sharing the same food with each other, talking about the food together, you know, experiencing it together and connecting with each other over. And food is so multi-pronged, right? Like, it's not just that connection as well that we have, but it's historical. It's like the love of our grandparents and ancestors. And I mean, I suppose I come from the tradition where we may not articulate love so much. I mean, that's something that we try to change now in the in with our children. But you know, I came from a culture where love was articulated through cooking and through doing things for other people, and for showing concern or care, or the little things that you would do for each other that were not verbalized,
and acts of service.
Absolutely. And I think that was a big thing for me growing up, and for me observing in the previous generations as well, that were not involved in like raising me, but like, you know, me observing my parents with my grandparents and things like this. I think that these little, like, you know, altruistic kind of acts of preparing food or concerns about food for you and your health and your well-being is so integral to feeling safe and loved and cherished.
And when you say that, I'm thinking about how, like, what food does for us, right? It sustains our livelihood. And when like collectivist cultures such as ours are just constantly feeding us, because it is a love language, and like I'm a feeder as well. It is my love language as well. So I think it comes from a sense whereby I care about you and your livelihood.
Yeah.
Hence, I want to feed you and make sure you'll stay alive and be well within yourself, in terms of like, and the best way I can do this is by giving you nutrition. Obviously, there are a lot of other ways that we have established now where we can show love, and it doesn't have to be through food. But yeah, it's interesting.
It's a very curious thing, isn't it? Like, culture and tradition. And, you know, I think I've been thinking a lot about the Western view of psychology and our cultural lenses that, you know, and that you're the expert in that as well, like looking through cultural lenses. And I think about, you know, absolutely no culture is perfect, but in wanting to, you know, improve or to get more articulation of love and things, that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Like, in that sense, that there's some of these really beautiful things about our culture that dedication, I mean, like, you know, that our parents had for us, and a lot of in pursuing just words of, like, you know, words of affirmation that we probably don't have a lot in our culture. That wasn't a common thing to get those words of affirmation. Yeah. But in pursuing that, I don't want to lose these acts of service. I know, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a way that even though they were not articulated, we knew that we were cared for and loved. And, you know, sometimes just saying, like, words almost a much easier than those eggs. And so by just saying, I wish this was my culture or this was the way it is, I don't want that to take away from the beauty as well. I mean, like, of the culture that we did come from. And that, so it's a very, I suppose what I'm trying to say, and this is my viewpoint, you know, is that it's heart bridging having one foot in each world and also seeing the beauty in each one and trying to pull from that into our lives and into, you know, being able to also view it through a cultural lens when we work with our clients.
And I think that brings to mind the word transculturalism, because now we are, especially in Australia, we are, I wouldn't even say we're multicultural anymore, we're transcultural. We bring so much cultural hybridity in our lives and within ourselves, and we identify with so many different cultures as well. So, for example, if I were to use myself in my life as an example, I'm from Singapore, which is Southeast Asia. I grew up around a lot of Chinese people. My best friend was Chinese. I'm Indian, and I'm, you know, was born Muslim as well. And then I went to the Middle East. I'm not Arab, but I identify with so many of the Arabian cultures and the language. And, you know, there's, of course, the religious aspect as well that was kind of ingrained and inherited from young. And then, you know, my sisters and my family lived in Central Asia, so they've absorbed some of the, like, Russian cultures there as well. And then we've lived in Australia, which is just so colorful culturally. And having gone to international schools for since from the age of 13 until 18, which is a long time, formative years, being exposed to all of that, which is very Western but also just super eclectic, and then here I am, like you say, I'm trying to hold on to the cultures and the values that we've inherited. And even that would be like Southeast Asian, Arabian, South Asian, because of the Indian aspect as well. And then the Central Asian that comes in a little bit here and there. And then also wanting to embrace the science and the Western approaches that also work. And we're just constantly toggling. And every time life throws us a spanner, we're just like, okay, well, how am I going to navigate through this dilemma, whether it's moral or ethical or, you know, spiritual, whatever it is. According to all these inherited cultures and beliefs and values.
I mean, and your knowledge and your skill sets that on top of that as well, right? So there's so many lenses that we view the world through.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, I mean, we can see it as a challenge, but we can also see it as, you know, our unique strength in being able to almost see it from all these different point of views. And I think, you know, for us being multilingual, like being able to speak another language, that comes with it as well a different way of thinking.
Definitely.
And like different phrasings and different emphasis, and so that is a different lens that we view through as well. So it's definitely an advantage but also a challenge, I think, to have a lot of that viewpoints. And I think it's a challenge when it comes to raising the next generation and figuring out what to preserve and what to, you know, the traditions and cultures to preserve, and what to then, you know, instill in them, and things that we didn't have growing up as well. And how do we bring that about, you know, through the things that we do? So it's definitely progress. If I think about it that way.
And if I think about it a bit more, it makes it, I think you need some level of creativity and flexibility to adopt that dynamic kind of back and forth and constant reevaluation. And especially if your family itself is intercultural or interfaith, like, you also have to learn how to be respectful of each other and also compromise, you know. There's so many challenges that come along with cultural diversity. It sounds really pretty and nice on paper, you know, like, oh, United Nations, we all wear different things, we experience each other's cultures. But when we're face to face with some really strong core values with our loved ones, where do we take it from there? Because you have all your inherited beliefs and values as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions that we may have about each other or that about too, ourselves even. And we don't know when we are, what maybe some of even our values or core beliefs are until it's challenged. Until we experience that, you know, that hurt or that pain within us. And we're like, I didn't know that there was an issue even for me. And then it comes to the fold, okay, there are some things there. And then the question then I suppose is, you know, what's beautiful about this core belief still that I want to preserve, but yet being able to, being open to being challenged by it as well? Because I think, like, looking through cultural lens of things, I mean, certainly things like, you know, how we approach, like, conversations with our elders or our parents is certainly not the same way the Western society wants us to approach a lot of those, communications, right? And I think, you know, what's the harm in putting a cultural lens through the way we communicate and the way we set boundaries, the way we respectfully, you know, learn and grow as ourselves, but in a space that we can be authentic to ourselves, but also to be culturally sensitive.
Yeah. And I think personally, or at least professionally, when I approach these matters with clients, it would be, let's establish what your core values are, cultural or not, like what is important to you, so that whatever it is that you do is going to feel authentic, and therefore it will be sustainable. And then we can only craft these sort of, like, I guess, strategies forward in terms of perhaps forming boundaries with, you know, family members, for instance. But it will not be sustainable if it doesn't sit right with you. So we really have to start with you and, you know, what you feel is right or not.
And I think that extends to even those lifestyle strategies, you know, that we have as well, like things like, you know, how important community is, but community looks different for everyone, right? And different ways, how important it is to share meals with others, but that looks different for everyone in different ways as well. So it just finding, I think being open, I think is the beauty that we bring, I suppose, is that openness towards all these different, you know, values that are coming forward, the traditions, the beliefs, the culture, layers upon layers, to look at each individual as a unique individual that has a lot of these things that they want and they may not even be aware of in their inside of them. And it's for us, I suppose, to then be able to meet them where they're at and see then, you know, what works and what gels with them. So it's really like almost like tailor suiting strategies and interventions to each individual, because, you know, both of us grew up in Singapore, but we certainly come from very, like, you know, I'm just listening to your background and your experiences, that is very different from me as well, right? And and being a migrant to another country, but also migrant upon migrant, you know, in that sense, because, like, as Singaporeans, we are all migrants. And so, and identifying with the Singapore culture is different for me as it is for you as well, as the heritage and the history coming from our, like, you know, origin countries. I don't know how to say it. Like, you know, our historical origin countries.
And, like, our ancestry.
I think that plays a part. I mean, certainly, you know, things that our parents or grandparents would have said to us about values or what is right and wrong. It's not universal.
No, definitely not. And I think one of the things that comes to mind when you're talking, I just think about how I normally start to approach issues around building boundaries within the family system and also within the self that is, you know, coherent with values is the virtue of compassion. And, you know, virtue is something that you, it's not a value, it is something that you actually have to keep working on, you know, to enhance and to hone and to strengthen. So if compassion is there, it's really easy not say really easy, no, it's easier. It's easier to be flexible. It's easier to be open. It's easier to adopt a different perspective. And also it's easier to not be so defensive, right? And then when you have compassion to start from, then you're able to soften your approaches and tailor your approaches a little bit better because there's less resistance, psychologically at least. That's what I think.
Yeah, I do love the way you think and, you know, how you look so deeply into what for a lot maybe just superficially looking at issues and problems, and especially when we're connecting as people, in it's that opportunity for us to then put away our defensiveness, or like, and that, I suppose, what are we defending? Are we defending our ego, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Our ego. So it's almost like we're putting away this preciousness of ourselves to truly be able to hear what's coming forward. Because I think ultimately what we want as people is to be able to understand ourselves, that self-awareness piece, but also to be able to then look and see where we're going to grow and how we're going to grow. And the most important thing, I suppose, to grow as people is to grow in our minds, in our being, in our ways of connecting and communicating. So it's beautiful, Amira.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And earlier, before we started recording, we talked about, well, you mentioned intention and intentionality and how you speak with people about that in terms of your decisions and whether or not, actually, before I waffle on, tell me more about your stance on intention.
Yeah, I mean, I think recognizing, first of all, that we're all human, you know, and that we, as well-intended people, will make mistakes in our lives and in our communication. And so instead, I suppose, even with parenting, not just stating what needs to happen, but saying the intention behind the communication. So, you know, like, my hope and dream is for us to be able to connect, or for us to be able to, you know, have some more clarity on the situation. I'm human, I make mistakes, I have that kind of, you know, I lay down that information and that intention, and that frames a lot of the communication. Because when you say things like this with people that you love, it breaks down, I suppose, the I need to win in this situation.
The defensiveness.
Yeah, that defensiveness, because the ego comes up, right? And that sense that I need to win, because ultimately, it's not about that at all, right? I mean,
what are you trying to win?
Yeah, you're communicating because you want to love them, or you want to support them, or you're afraid for their future, or you have your own insecurities or your own belief systems that things need to happen in particular ways or particular sequences. And I think it's important to say, like, you know, this, I'm just coming from that best intention, and having that communication to be open that way, and that frames and it breaks down the walls of you're attacking me if I'm saying that that's the intention. I'm intending to communicate, I'm intending to connect. And I mean, whether that's with you know, from parent to child, or from you know, partners, lovers, you know, just sometimes we get caught up in the, I don't understand what's happening, or I don't understand what we're trying to achieve here, and I have this thing and you're not understanding, you're not hearing me. But when I communicate from a sense of intention, and I'm saying things like, you know, I just want to connect, or I just want to be able to let you know what I think, or I want to work on this together, I want to be on this journey together, I don't need maybe solutions, but I need us to work this out together. So when you're kind of framing what I'm needing from the situation, or my intention of the communication, then I think it sets up towards having a more, for lack of a better word, successful communication.
I think when you're intentional, or you're being intentional, and I think this is something that, again, can be a muscle that we work. I don't think it's something we're born with inherently, because when we are we're kids, we're just obsessed with ourselves, right? Like, self-gratification and all that. So, with intentionality, when you were talking, what comes to my mind is humility and vulnerability. And it can be challenging for many people to take that step down and be vulnerable with the other consciously. You know, you have to be conscious about it as well.
Yeah.
And especially when there's a power imbalance, like a parent, child, teacher, student, you know, that sort of thing. The spirit of collaboration often gets overshadowed by that power indifference.
Yeah, I think, you know, and just recognizing that we're human and that not every connection and communication is going to be perfect, but that it's not a one-time situation, right? Life, you know, is not about pinpoint little times. There's so much opportunity to bridge that again in the future. What I mean by that is that, you know, we may say things in a heated moment. We're human, right? Like, you know, we might have that disruption in our relationship, but we can come back with a sense of openness and vulnerability when I'm in a better headspace to say, like, you know, I don't think I handled that really well, or, you know, I think that was coming out from my history, or, you know, my insecurities, and be able to then connect again in the future as well. So I think sometimes we have to be kind to ourselves, and we think back, and I think as we're saying these things, sometimes we can reflect on some of these challenging conversations and we go like, oh, I wish I handled that better.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, it's good to be able to learn, but it's also not good to dwell. So to be able to say, you know what, it happened, it's in the past, and I can't do anything about that whatsoever to change that event, right? But what I am now is in the present, and I can do something about the present, and I can reach out and I can connect again, or I can, you know, communicate in a different way, or be able to be human in a different way. And look, I do that a lot. I mean, as a parent, you know, sometimes you get caught up. You get caught up in, you know, in thinking everything is going to escalate or to move down a path of doom and gloom if you allow something to happen.
Yeah.
And then it can, you can get a bit of a tunnel vision, right, in that point where you start to think that this is the only solution, and you push your point. And, you know, and then when you have a moment to pause and cool down, then you recognize that there's a lot of more options and we could be more open, and being able to come back and say, you know what, like, that was me speaking from this part, and that I was concerned about these things, and to be able to have that next conversation again.
It's permission to be human as well, isn't it? Like, you have to give yourself permission for that, because otherwise you'll just end up being in this, like, analysis paralysis state, or rumination, or regret, you know, when you realize that you didn't handle it the way you wanted to handle it.
I mean, it's about modeling, isn't it? Like, that I mean, I think if you think about the greatest gift that you can give to the future generation is for you to be well, for you to be, you know, to find yourself, to be okay with yourself and to be happy with yourself. And then you're able to then be empathetic, to be graceful to others, right? So I think that is, you know, is that modeling that they don't really learn from what we say, but rather how we say it and what we do, right? So if you think that it's super important to get it right, it's, first of all, it's life, right? It's not one pinpoint. It's all, you know, we talk, and I remember we learned about good enough parenting.
I think it was 60% good is good enough. Like, they'll remember you well.
Right. And I think the 40% is also about acknowledging that we are human and articulating that we are human. I think it's not only important to just pretend that you are the super parent kind of thing, but to say and articulate and say it to your children that maybe I didn't handle that well, or maybe I could have done this differently and stuff like that. And even in therapy, like, even with our clients, we are also human. Let's just, you know, there is that power differential as well, right? But we are human and we are there. And sometimes you will ponder upon a session and think, you know, maybe we could have done a different thing, or we can bring something else up, or, you know, I felt that when you said certain things that I didn't, you know, I wasn't able to attend to you as best as I could. We're human. I think we should talk about these things. I think that that's part of modeling how to be human as part of the therapeutic approach as well, that we bring our own humanity and our own imperfections as, you know, something that we are not afraid of.
In normalizing.
We normalize it. We're all flawed, you know.
Yeah.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to Science of the Soul. This is a short interruption to let you know that if you or someone you know are in need of more support, you can find me at Road to Recovery on my Facebook page, my Instagram, or my website at aroadtorecovery.org. I hope you've enjoyed listening so far, and now let's get back to the podcast.
And I guess in a therapeutic setting as well, it kind of helps our clients not put us on a pedestal because we don't really belong there.
Yeah.
We've just learned a few things and progressed in a career of, you know, learning about the human mind and whatnot and helping that out. But that's it to an extent. Like, we're still human. We are still flawed.
Yeah.
We are still trapped in our imperfections, whatever it is.
Absolutely. I think it's the, if I can paint a picture, it's like walking beside you, right?
Mm.
But not in front of you, but we are just there beside you as you go through. You know, we can see certain things, we will talk about it, but we are walking this journey with you.
Mm.
So yeah.
So lifestyle medicine.
Yeah, back to strategies. You know what's interesting? There was this recent article, I think maybe lots of us may have seen it in the news as well, about exercise for depression.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the different exercises that might be most effective for depression is based on things like gender and age.
Mm.
But also bearing in mind that all exercise will have benefit for your well-being, your physical health and your mental health.
Yeah.
In fact, if they could bottle exercise in a pill, that would be like one of the most effective sort of medications out there.
Well, I do propose exercise to, I think, all of my clients who, yeah. Well, the ones that already exercise, they know the benefits. So I don't talk about it too much, except for, have you exercised lately since, you know, you have experiencing a slump. But in general, that is usually something I do go to, like your sleep,
mm-hmm.
your exercise, are you eating well?
Mm-hmm.
And are you isolated, like the four protective factors, right?
Yep.
So yeah, tell me a bit more about the types of exercise that support the well-being of different genders and age.
Yeah, it was very interesting because I think why it was so interesting is because it wasn't what we expected.
Okay, tell me.
So, okay, few things. One thing is that autonomy in exercise is not as effective as you think. What I mean by that is that just allowing people to choose and feel a sense of autonomy in their ability to choose what they want to do for exercise leads people to just not do any exercise.
Oh.
So, you know, when we think like autonomy is really important scientifically or theoretically, but in as evidence-based, autonomy wasn't as important. And this was a big systematic review and a meta-analysis. So it's looking at 200 over articles and like 1400 like participants. So it was a big study, and please do not quote me if I get some of the details wrong, because me and Mira are just talking here. But I think that was an interesting point. And the other interesting point as well is that the exercises that were slightly more effective for men were things like yoga and qigong,
which is opposite of what they'd be inclined to what. So basically, you have to go against your gradient and your proclivities. And I think Andrew Huberman talked about this, and he talked about how this stimulates the anterior singular
let's not go into the scientific details.
Well, but that part of the brain is the thing that thrives from you doing things that are not comfortable.
Yeah, and that might be a really important factor as well, or it could be things, and this is just hypothesis, not part of the data, but hypothesis that, you know, things like maybe for just typically for the male gender, typically is not as present and not as mindful and not as, so having those things is that combination of doing, you know, like things that are more present, more mindful, that has benefits beyond physical activity.
Okay.
So there the may yin. be, yeah, like there may be some parts of, like, you know, qigong is something that my grandmother used to do in the park. And by the way, it's not, a lot of times qigong is not done in isolation. So it is done in a community setting. It is done in the parklands, you know. It's done with other people. And like the way my grandmother used to practice it was that she would meet up with all her friends in the morning. Like, I would go to school, she would go to the park with all her friends, and they would do qigong together. And after that, they would all go and eat breakfast together. And then after that, they would go to the market. And then that is the day. Every weekday was structured that way.
Wow.
How important is that for that sense of routine, that sense of community? And so there, and I mean, of course, and that practice, which is so mindful and so bringing it down to micro, like, movements, and how you know, you're moving your energies through those kind of places, that intention in every movement. It's beautiful to watch. If you have never seen people do qigong, it's actually very beautiful to watch as well. And the other interesting thing was that for women, it was strength training, which is maybe not as typical, which is, I mean, it's more typical now, I would say, like, you know, to do strength training. But that brought about a lot of benefits for, and this is specifically for depression. So we're not talking about, this study wasn't talking about any other mental health, or not talking about well-being. It was talking specifically about depression. So I found that that was an interesting finding, but at the same time, don't blow it out of proportion, because any exercise, as long as you like it, you want to do it, you should try it. Like, you know, instead of fixating that these are the only ones that are good and I don't like them, so I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah. And so, then moderation, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And also, nothing is a magic bullet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's always used alongside and in conjunction with other therapies. But exercise is a really important part of life. So a lot of these kind of factors are things that we talk about in terms of lifestyle medicine. And we know the evidence base behind that.
What are the greatest resistance that you often experience from clients when you try to, I guess, move them along in their well-being?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think, you know, I do work with predominantly young adults. And their other lifestyle choices come into more importance for them, you know, like staying out, partying, or having, you know, it's usually sleep that is a very challenging factor, I suppose, that we deal with. But they have other values, I think, at that point. And you know what?
Other priorities,
that's right. And we were young ones.
Yeah.
So I can totally recognize and understand that it's, you know, it's something that they want to try out and do. But then, of course, it's impacting on well-being. And if they're coming to me for support, then their well-being is quite significantly impacted by the come-down. So then it's just a matter of saying, okay, let's start small, and then we can build upon these habits. So, you know, sleep is a really important one to start with, because when you don't have the energy to carry out the rest of your day, you don't won't want to exercise, you won't want to eat well, you just, you know, a lot of these other factors are sort, like, sleep is kind of like the keystone habit, like that needs to happen first before a lot of these other things can happen. But you start to recognize when you start to, you know, improve on these lifestyle choices that you have, and start to prioritize your well-being, that a lot of times, sometimes, you know, yes, you have some challenging beliefs and core beliefs, and you have some, but a lot of them may not seem so much of a challenge to deal with when you have the physical and mental strength to deal with them. So, you know, or, you know, even relationship issues may not be as opaque as they are, you know, like you can't see through, you can't figure out a way out when you are not sleep deprived.
And being sleep deprived from personal experience, it does heighten a lot of your emotions, and it does, you know, exacerbate them. The negative ones, definitely the negative ones, not so much the positive ones. No one who is sleep deprived wakes up, like, after 2 hours of sleep and goes, like, wow, the sun is just magical. It's more like, oh.
Yeah.
And sleep really punctuates your life, right? If, imagine if you go, Da Vinci probably did this, if you go through life just barely sleeping, there's no end and beginning. Mm. And that can really play on your mind, because that just means that you're just having this one really long like life, and you're constantly fighting, and you're constantly putting out fires. There's no reprieve and rest, and there's so much obviously neurochemistry that's happening, but just the just mentally, there's no stop. Like, we need a stop and we need a start. We don't go on, you know, like, we just don't go on and on and on and on. That's just not how we operate.
Yeah. And the thing with sleep is that it's almost like, you know, it's a bit of like chicken and egg issue, because a lot of times people who experience high levels of anxiety or worries have trouble sleeping, right? Because that's they're thinking very much about these things, and because they have trouble sleeping and they have, you know, loss of energy, they have a lot more caffeine maybe that they're using in the day, that's also impacting on their anxiety, then it's impacting on their sleep. And so it's a bit of like a cycle that perpetuates and exacerbates the situation, because you know, there's, like you say, there's no stop point to that. And it's almost as if, let's just tackle it at any point that you are able to see some clarity at this point. So if it is some ways, and definitely with sleep, sometimes it's easier to start with these physical habits, because we have some more concrete ways of working through, like, your bedtime routine. We can actually be a bit more investigative and go like, okay, what's happening? What time is your last coffee? What time are you waking up in the morning? Are you having naps in the afternoon?
There's troubleshooting happening,
like, what is your dinner like? Are you eating too close to bedtime? You know, do you, what are you doing with your screen time in the evenings? Are you dimming your lights? How are you, you know, being able to put aside maybe some of the thoughts? Are you doing some lists, you know, in the evening to help put aside some of those things that keep swimming inside your head? Are you watching something calming in the evening, or are you watching like horrors and things that you're thinking about that a lot? So a lot of different ways we can work with your sleep, bedtime routine. A bedtime routine is really important. It does make a difference in, you know, how you will function the next day, and how you, how much you enjoy your life, how much you love yourself.
And the quality of the sleep as well, right? Your bedtime routine is, it impacts the quality of your sleep tremendously. Like, you can just, if you're the kind of person that can just kind of let your head hits the pillow and that's it, lights out, I mean, good for you. I'm sure
that is me.
That's you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's me to an extent as well.
Yeah.
So I think with that, I find myself slack in terms of bedtime routine, because I know that when I'm tired and I put my head down, I'm just going to sleep anyways.
Yeah.
But the quality of my sleep is not going to be good. And it's harder for me to motivate myself to do the bedtime routine for the sake of sleep quality. If I had trouble sleeping, I'll be more motivated to, you know, invest in sleep hygiene.
Yeah, and I think you will notice a difference if you are structuring it a little bit more. I certainly have noticed a difference on having, like, say, lights, like only dim lights, you know, in past like 8 o'clock, you know, and stuff like this, and just spending some time communicating, talking, and just calming down and not focusing on work or on different strategic approaches for everything, which always swim around my head, but just being able to talk about like nothing, you know, like things that have low weight, and communicate. But I mean, like, you know, that also shows then the importance of having someone that you can communicate with as well. And if you don't, then maybe even having a way of, you know, communicating with yourself through journaling and things like this as well, to just put yourself in a different headspace to bring upon the rest for the night.
And there's this concept of inertia as well, whereby, you know, when you're in that zone or working through that level of go go go, or, you know, like do not be, to switch to the being mode, or to consciously, you know, go like, okay, time to wind down. I mean, a lot of people would have like a glass of wine, for example, in Australia, but in different cultures there are many different other things that people employ to kind of make that switch. Okay, now it's time for me to sit down and do my whatever, you know? And if we don't have that little something or a couple of things that we do to kind of cue us into winding down and switching gears, then we'll probably get into bed still thinking about what are we going to do. Oh, on that, I wanted to share, because I've been doing a little bit of work on philosophy, and one of the things that I learned about was Pythagoras's practice of premeditation about what you're going to do the next day. And I think David Goggins as well, he would spend hours planning his next day. I don't know if we'll need hours if we're not like a pro athlete, like ex-Navy SEAL kind of person. But the practice was basically, I think Pythagoras said do it in the morning, but I've been doing it in the evening because I find it more helpful and helps me sleep or switch off at least. Basically, think about what you're going to do tomorrow. All the things that you have, you know, lined up. And then think about all the things that can go wrong and plan for that. So contingency plans. And also think, when you're thinking about things that may not go accordingly, you're also setting yourself up for not so much of a shock impact when things don't go well or don't go accordingly. So anxiety is more managed and disappointment is managed. And you go like, all right, cool, whatever. Like, I've thought about this. Even if it was just for a minute, a moment, I have thought about this. So that has been a very helpful way for me personally to kind of shift gears once I start thinking about the next day and do my Pythagorean premeditation sequence. That's when my mind goes like, all right, cool.
Yeah.
I'm good. Yeah. We can go to bed now.
And I think, you know, the other thing you were talking about as well is like the cues and the spaces that we are in and that how important it is in our minds. Like, you know, like you've got the lights bright on, you've got your laptop still, your work laptop especially still on. Your brain is like, well, this is work time. This is, you know, cueing you to be alert and attentive, because what if you miss something? And so a lot of times I work with, you know, clients on like segregating spaces and having physical rituals as well to separate like spaces, or to separate your the work self from, you know, the home self, or the relaxed self from the working self. Especially if you work for yourself and you work from home, it is really important to find ways to like put aside things or put away things to, in your mind, even to shift that space. So it's a physical, it's like physical space, but your mind has to use the physical space to shift mentally into a different space. So even like things like scents, smells, you can use smells to shift space as well. You know, like if you want to use like citrus scents during the day, it really brings on a sense of, you know, invigoration and like, you know, being energized. And then using much more calming like lavender scents and stuff like during the night times to tell yourself, okay, this is not the same space that we are in. Lighting is another big one. People who work in a very like, sometimes especially students in a dorm room, that is their whole world, right? They live in there, they do their work,
and the
in
lighting
there.
Is horrid. It's horrid.
So things that they can do to shift, like, you know, getting little bits of things. I even like get students to like you know, put like a pretty scarf over their workstation when it is done for the day. It's almost that ritual of putting the scarf over the station. This is now complete. This is no longer a space of work. This is now a space of rest and a space of, you know, being gentle with myself. And I've been hard with myself the whole day at work.
To demarcate that quite obviously,
yes, right? Physically demarcate. I think it's important. And things like not doing, even if you're in a very small space, not doing work on your bed, or, you know, like bed especially is really just for sleep and other things, like, you know, not doing work on your bed, not trying to be productive in your bed space, because your mind is confused as when it is in that space as to whether this is productive time or it is rest time. And there's a lot more of a cognitive load in trying to tell yourself that this is a different space, it's a different space, I need to work on my strategies and just shift.
Rather than just physically do that.
Physically be in a different space, or physically set some boundaries in your space, even if you have a very small space.
It reminds me of training a pet, right? Your mind just, Your mind needs to feel and see and sense. Your mind needs to sense. Your brain needs to get this sensory input in order for it to understand. You can't think it into you want it to do. You need to...
That's right. Make it easy for yourself.
Train it in a different way.
That's right. Make it easy for yourself to be in a different headspace by shifting your physical environment rather than trying to shift your thoughts into a different headspace.
Yeah. Because then you keep resisting your own thoughts. If people do meditation, you understand that the more you want something to happen, the more it won't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. Yeah. Perfect analogy there.
Well, thank you so much for all the insight you've shared with us. Is there anything else you'd like to?
I think that's been good. It's been really good. Even for my own clarity of thought to talk it out with you. For inviting me to share.
My pleasure. It's been lovely to connect with you on this level. And now let's go party. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Bye.